I've got a suggestion for him. Get a job!
Nice!
Get a job, bikey Skype.
That's not very nice now, is it?
Season 3, episode 18, and we're back, and we're very excited.
We are,
we're very excited.
Radio is the name of the show.
It's got nothing to do with the fact that we've got to do a 1 minute intro.
Matthew Rebell's my name.
Adrian Bradshaw is my name, hello.
My name is John O'Bacon.
And I'm Stuart Langridge.
We'll talk to Matthew East of the Ubuntu Documentation Project.
UDP, yes.
Documentation Project.
Ubuntu Documentation Project.
Documentation. We'll make docs.
We're mean to make
that. Gareth Bowker of the FSF Europe.
Talking about FSF Europe street fighting.
Oh, well, there's an element of that, yeah.
The Punch Up, and we can talk about eye candy.
We are.
Yep.
And finally, about a bit more of an update about Lug Radio Live.
It's going to be Gwardek. The greatest, greatest.
Gwardek. Oh, and Gwardek, which we're going to. We're going to Gwardek.
So
should you be.
Let's get on with it.
Hi, Matt East, or MDKE, perhaps pronounced Mudkey, I don't know. How are you? Talk to us.
Hi, I'm very well, thank you. Nice to speak to you.
Now, Matthew, what is it that you do? I understand you're involved in documentation and things like that.
I help out on the Ubuntu documentation project, writing some documentation and organising some things within the team.
Cool. I mean, within the open sourcey world, documentation sometimes gets a bit of a back seat. What do you reckon is key to getting people involved in documentation? So we've got a lot more in the way of non-coders coming on board into the community now.
Yeah.
How can they, if they're able to write and all of that sort of thing, how can they find their way into something like the Ubuntu Documentation Project?
Yeah, well, as you say, it's a really good place to start if you want to start contributing to open source, because Linux and open source in general is starting to attract, not just complete geeks, a lot of people with different skills, and people who can't necessarily code and who are interested in writing and have technical writing skills. It's a great way for them to contribute, and it's also a good entry point for the community. You can then, you can start helping out with some documentation, and then you can move on and you get to know the community as a whole and do other things as well.
Cool. I mean, okay. I remember about sort of 3 or 4 years ago, I did a bit of documentation, and back then, to get involved in any kind of documentation project, which was the Linux documentation project back then, you had to know LaTeX and SGML and all that kind of stuff.
Oh, that sounds very scary.
It was horrific. What's it like nowadays?
Things have moved on a lot.
Now you have to know dogbook.
Yeah, dogbook instead.
Well, that's the top end. The easy end to get into is, you can, as long as you know how to write words, you can submit words.
Right.
Now, other contributors will always be happy to, if you submit bug reports or paragraphs, just write emails or whatever with material, people will always mix it in with the documentation.
Okay.
But the main, at least in the Ubuntu community, and I think this applies also to a lot of other communities now, is the wiki technology has taken off, and that's a really good way to contribute documentation without learning complicated forms of markup.
Yeah. So the important point is that you don't have to be a technical whiz. If people listen to the show now and they want to write some documentation because they know a piece of software, they don't have to be massively technical. Is that right?
Absolutely not. I mean, in fact, you can start contributing just by, proofreading things and pointing out spelling mistakes, and then you can write guides. You can do anything as long as you just have to know, your level of English has to be reasonably good, and you just have to know how to write.
Yeah,
and, it doesn't take anything really to learn a wiki markup and just to write a few paragraphs in. And as time goes on, it'll get easier and easier. There are a lot of what you see and what you get editors coming in. And
Known as WYSIWYG.
Really, there are no barriers to entry except for knowing how to write sentences.
Cool. I mean, one of the problems with documentation historically has been that if you want to start off documenting a product, you don't know about it because there isn't any documentation.
Yeah.
And when you put the effort in to learn about it, you don't need the documentation anymore, so you don't write it.
Yeah.
Well, are you doing anything to kind of alleviate? I don't know how you'd alleviate that.
Make
but
software harder.
Maybe software should be harder, so you actually need documentation for it.
Well, I think the answer is, once you've learned about it, you want to help other people to learn about it, so you're not writing for yourself anymore, you're writing to help people who maybe were in your position when you started learning it, and you help them get into it much more quickly.
Yeah, because by the sounds of it, what's happening now is that we're having people who dedicate their open source time to developing documentation rather than just, oh, I've worked out how to do this, maybe I'll write it up.
Sure, and it's quite an altruistic way of contributing, really, because, you know, you maybe won't even use the documentation yourself.
Yeah.
You're just doing it for other people. And there's quite a lot of good collaboration in most communities, I think, between the people developing the software, who obviously know exactly how it works, and the people writing the documentation. Either it's the same person, or, you know, they'll be happy to answer questions and stuff, and that's certainly true of the Ubuntu developers. They've been very helpful. Just, you know, if you want to know how something works, if you've got a question about something, they'll answer it, and then you can stick it in the guide that you're writing.
You mentioned earlier that really the only barrier to entry is the ability to write a sentence. What sort of quality control is there? Because I would have thought that the documentation for particularly a high-profile project such as Ubuntu needs to be really clearly written, needs to basically be very high quality. Otherwise, you're presenting a bit of a shoddy face to the world who, some of them, let's face it, might come to open source thinking, well, it's open source, it's going to be crap. So we need every single...
You need to convince people.
Yeah, we need every single point of quality.
It's one of the big challenges, I think, quality control and documentation. What we do in the Ubuntu project is that we have a sort of filter mechanism where anyone in the community can contribute to the wiki. And the documentation that gets shipped with the distribution and gets put at the top of the website is open to members of the documentation team. So that's the quality assurance method that we use. And in order to start contributing to the documentation that we put in the distribution, we ask people to submit some patches and to demonstrate basically that they've read and understood our style guide and that they're writing good quality stuff.
Right. I mean, how do you end up, though, in the first place? Say you've got a project that doesn't yet have a documentation team.
Such as Jacosha.
Yeah. Right, yeah, I mean, I'm going to be writing the documentation for Jacosha, by the sounds of it. But, I mean, say for a slightly larger project that might have a group of people who are interested in developing docs for it.
Yeah.
From your experience, how do they go about organising themselves and working out all the, you know, basically the meritocracy of it? Because as Mitchell Baker said in his blog post regarding Mozilla, we know as a community how to push people up the tree when they're coders and when they're submitting bug patches and things like that. How do you do that with something like documentation? Because, you know, you might have one guy who thinks he's the greatest writer in the world, but perhaps, you know, overcomplicates things or doesn't have the quite the right grasp of style. How do you work out who's best to do what?
First of all, I think a style guide helps, and most documentation projects tend to either adopt an existing style guide or lay down their own. That helps, and I think it's very important to have some kind of access control as to who starts getting access to commit, you know, documentation that users are actually going to see. So, in the case of very high-profile documents, basically, if you're starting with one person, that one person can ask other contributors to submit patches to him, and then he can merge them in if he likes them. And once he gets to know a few people and they're consistently submitting high-quality stuff, then, you know, maybe he can give them access, and then the team can grow from there. That's basically how the Ubuntu documentation team
very similar to software, in fact.
Sorry?
Very similar to software,
yeah,
in fact.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. There's no reason why it shouldn't be different.
As part of the Ubuntu documentation team specifically, how much of the stuff you write is Ubuntu-specific, and how much of it goes up the tree to... goes upstream so other distributions can take advantage of it?
That's a very good question. At the moment, everything that the Ubuntu documentation team produces, and in fact everything that the Ubuntu community produces by way of documentation, is Ubuntu specific. And that's obviously not a good thing. It's the reason it's like that is that it's simply easier, and it's much more, it's a difficult task to actually integrate upstream documentation in an effective way with distro-specific documentation. And I think that's going to be one of the big challenges for the future, particularly for the Ubuntu documentation team, is how best to use the wealth of upstream documentation that is available. And, you know, make it appropriate for Ubuntu by doing, you know, the relevant patches on it.
Just quickly, did I just hear you say that one of the problems with the current situation is that the documentation that you guys produce is very Ubuntu-specific?
Right, well...
Because to me, if it's not Ubuntu-specific, then it's pointless, isn't it?
No, okay, I was unclear. What I mean is that we're producing documentation only for Ubuntu and we're not using very effectively documentation that comes from upstream. So,
right.
A specific example is Ubuntu uses the GNOME desktop, and GNOME produces a lot of quite good documentation.
Quite good.
Among which is, for example, an accessibility guide and a desktop user guide. Mm. Now, the Ubuntu documentation that we produce doesn't integrate well with that. And the reason is it's simply the documentation team hasn't been able to take on the task of patching the upstream documentation to make it relevant to Ubuntu and to ensure that, you know, everything works with the modifications that Ubuntu has made to its desktop. So I think that's something that we need to look at for the future, because there's a lot of upstream documentation that can be really, really relevant and really helpful.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. One very quick question. If you want to find documentation for something, for an application you're using, you go out and Google for it, if there isn't anything that comes with it.
Yeah.
You find an awful lot of documents out there which are out of date because they were written in 2002 or something like that. And it's a really, really big problem, because you start following some document and you think, right, okay, and then it's nothing like that. And you go and ask on the IRC channel and they say, yeah, we abandoned that in 2004, but no one ever bothered to write about it. Is there anything that can be done about that other than deleting half of the internet?
Well, there's not a lot. If you're using Google as your base, there's not really a lot that can be done, I have to say. For specific projects, I think a lot of projects maintain their own websites, and if you start there, then it's up to the project to make sure that their documentation is relevant, and you know, that's up to the project.
Fair enough.
Right.
So,
yep.
For Ubuntu, for example, you go to the Ubuntu Help website and you do a search for whatever it is you're looking for. And you should find information, and you should also find whether it's, you know, you should find the information as to whether it's relevant to the particular version of the program that you're using.
Sure. Right. Yeah. Just wrapping up, Mark Shuttleworth has been, he's spoken very publicly and in great depth about how Ubuntu are all about collaboration, and things like Launchpad are helping towards that. Where does the documentation sort of project fit in with that kind of collaborative vision? I mean, you know, people have used things like Gobi to collaborate on source code, you know, so it's an editor in which you can write documents, write code together. Is there kind of a tool chain developing to help documentation writers collaborate together more efficiently?
Collaborate with who, sorry?
With each other.
Between different projects.
Well, not only just between different projects, but within the same project. I mean, documentation seems to be a case of someone writes something, and then somebody writes something else, and then somebody fits them together. And there's obvious problems with style and grammar and things like that. So is there a tool chain developing to improve on that collaboration?
Yeah, sure, I think so. Well, the wiki technology is the best example of how that can be solved. You know, you've got documents that everyone can edit, and if someone finds a mistake, they dive in and fix it.
Yeah.
In terms of the distribution docs that we ship, we use a Subversion repository that all members of the team can dive in and collaborate on.
Right.
It's
as
simple as that, really.
Right. But there's a certain problem with that, I suppose, in the fact that, take, for example, somebody who knows how to use Ubuntu and has used a specific portion of Ubuntu. Let's say they use a particular application that's bundled with it. Knowing about subversion and knowing about patching and things like that, that's rather complicated, isn't it?
Yeah, that's true. There's no... I wouldn't make an attempt to hide that, but at the same, that's where the wiki comes in.
Right.
It's as simple as logging in and clicking edit, and then, you know...
So
the page is in front of you, and you can do what you like with it.
Right, so that's where the primary kind of collaboration happens.
Absolutely,
it's completely
open, and as long as you've got, you know, a Launchpad username, then you can log in and get going.
Cool. I mean, Jono mentioned Gobby there, the collaborative source code editor. As I understand it, the Abbey Word people have integrated LibObby, the thing which does the collaboration. So presumably you could get people writing documentation in Abbey Word and actually collaborating on the same document at the same time.
I'm not aware of that project, I have to say.
I mean, that's kind of what I was kind of angling towards, is that documentation at the moment seems to be a case of essentially marking things up. What would be cool, I think, in the future is if you could collaborate on style apart from anything, whereas Gobby is where you can essentially work together on the same document in a word processor type thing. And I'm just curious as to whether that sort of thing, but who knows? I mean, who knows?
Well, that would be very similar to a what you see is what you get editor front-end for a wiki, right?
Essentially, yeah, a WYSIWYG wiki in many ways.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, that sort of technology is around.
Yeah.
Definitely, and most wiki software has that built in now.
So, excellent. Well,
yeah, so that's looking good.
Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
You know, it's really important, the kind of work that you're doing, and hopefully this will encourage more people to get involved.
So where do they go? Just point them to our website if they're interested in Ubuntu, is doc.ubuntu.com. And if they're interested in contributing upstream, then that's great as well, and Google will tell them where to go.
Fantastic.
Thanks very much, mate.
Take care.
Bye.
The point you made there, Jono, about collaborative editing and so on, I thought was interesting.
Right.
I mean, Matt, you said that you didn't think it would work.
Oh, right. Yeah.
I don't think it would work, but that's coming from a position where I haven't actually tried it. And the reason I don't think it would
work... That's the usual Lug Radio position.
We haven't tried it, therefore it won't work, end of segment.
But the reason I don't think it would work is because when you're writing, it's a very personal thing. Even if you are writing it for a public bunch of people to read. Personally, the way that I write is I sit down, I'll make several revisions as I'm going. And the first thing that I'll spit out won't be ready for anyone to see. But if someone watches me doing that and then starts editing it themselves, I'll just get all confused and think...
Depends what kind of editing you're talking about.
There's a thing there. I wouldn't have thought it would work for source code either.
Right.
And then I've tried Gobby a couple of times, which is a collaborative source code editor. Literally, you get two cursors. You know, and one guy's typing one curse and the other guy's typing another. It's brilliant. Yeah. Really impressed with it. And there are two different types of coding you do. The first one is... I'm going to write this thing, and you start writing it. That's not really a collaborative thing. That's you taking the ideas in your head and spilling it out into an editor.
Yeah.
Then once you've got that file, and it does basically what you want, but you want to start editing it, fixing bugs in it, adding new features, then the collaborative stuff comes in handy.
Okay, I can see that.
So it's not necessarily for producing the initial draft of a document. It's for working on a document between a few of them.
Yeah, I can definitely see the benefit in that.
I think...
As I said in the thing, I mean...
So do you and Jono use this on Jocosha?
We haven't done. We've used it to hack on other things, but it was more kind of, oh, isn't this cool? Look, I could type at the same time as you.
And there's an element.
Shut up. Networks are just cool, as far as I'm concerned.
I think where it's interesting is, for example, you know, when I wrote my books, and when you've written your stuff as well.
Yeah.
Point to hack.
You know, you write something, in a word processor and then your editor sends it back and they've got tracking on.
Right.
And then you can see where you've made mistakes and they can insert comments. The problem with the wiki way of doing things is you can't do that. So the problem is that, let's say there are some
wikis with, sort of step back source control-y sorts of things.
But the problem is...
Media wiki does.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but the problem is that if you write, let's say I write something for the Ubuntu documentation project, and Matt East goes through it and he says, you know, go through the common things you need to write more actively, you need to fix this, you need to fix that, you need to cut down and length of sentences.
Sounds like the word grammar checker.
Things like that, right?
You have written this in the passive voice. I know! I deliberately wrote it in the passive voice.
If he goes through that, the only way you can do that really is to tell me in an email. Whereas, ideally you want, change tracking. You want that in your collaborative editor. That's one thing, because then the person who shares the knowledge can then show the person who wants the knowledge exactly how it can improve. And that's the fundamental thing in collaboration.
This is why I thought your question about the tool chain was interesting, because this kind of problem, to a large extent, was fixed a long time ago in source code editing. I mean, you have source control systems, and they're deliberately designed to help with this problem, but documentation's a bit behind it. I mean, the Word people have got track changes, and they've got notes that you can put in, and OpenOffice to some extent does that as well, and as I said, the Abbey Word at
the Abbey where people are integrating or have integrated libobby, which is the bit that makes Gobby a collaborative editor.
Hmm. So what's to stop them using Gobby then? What's to stop them using the existing?
Well, nothing, as far as I can tell. I can't see the reason why you couldn't write something in Gobby other than the fact that then you've got to write it as plain text.
But I write everything as plain text anyway because
and then mark it up afterwards.
Yeah, it's a lot easier. But
I don't write stuff as plain text and mark it up afterwards because that would annoy me.
But there's very individual ways of writing.
It depends on your different styles.
I mean, some people edit as they go along. Some people edit at the end.
But you don't want to say to people, yes, you can collaborate, but you have to change your writing style so you're a plain text and mark it up later person.
But I think the interest
pissed me off. Matt and Jono would like it.
I think the important thing about this is that at the moment, if you compare it to something like Source Control, essentially with Source Control, collaboration is only adding extra chunks of code to the code base. I mean, yes, you fix bits of code, but it's individual things. And it works well in that regard. So you've got five coders, each one of them makes commits. There's not that much actual collaboration in terms of working together.
I agree with that.
It's just individual drips of code dropped in.
Yeah.
The kind of collaboration I want to see is more like Gobby in the fact that, when I wrote Linux Desktop Hacks, that was one of the most valuable writing experiences for me because I got really genuine feedback from the editor, and the feedback that I got was very specific to parts. So he'd highlight three words and write a little comment about that. And that's the best thing about change tracking. And I think if you look at most documentation, I think they're doing a great job. But from a lot of documentation projects that I've seen, the writing's functional, but not necessarily the best writing.
Yeah.
And that's where that could come in useful, I think.
It concerned me to hear Matthew East say, when you were talking about the tool chain, basically say, well, we've got the wiki. Now, I do like wikis. I think they're good. They've got the place and everything. But what, I don't know if it's the same with coders, but with writers, certainly, I found that people tend to go through and they won't, for want of a better phrase, bug fix. They will rewrite things because personally they think it doesn't sound right. Hang on a sec.
Yes.
And
I'll just say,
also
yes,
with,
I agree.
And also,
shut up!
I always get interrupted on this program. No, anyway.
You're the only one.
Shut up. The other problem. The other problem,
I was going to say. Sorry, Matt, carry on.
The other problem with wikis is, as you say, it's kind of, it doesn't give you any of the tracking that you want. And I do think that's really important. I don't know if Gobi being perhaps source code, aimed at hackers is perhaps the best thing. I don't know. I haven't tried it.
But
we
one
do
thing
need something, don't we?
But the one thing that the wiki does do is what he was saying, is it lowers the bar totally.
Yes.
So if they don't know how to use those kind of tracking features, at least they can do something. They can at least get...
And really importantly, I think the documentation team should write documentation, not write tools to help them write documentation. Because that's what everybody does. They go, we could do this thing, but instead let's be hackers and build a tool to help us do it. And what happens is you get loads of tools and no actual content. In the same way that we've got loads of 3D engines things like that, and
framework,
no actual 3D
it?
Games. I mean, you don't want to write a framework for writing documentation. You want to write some frigging documentation.
But I think,
and that's what they're doing, which is brilliant. And like you say, the wiki allowing people to commit some words and then have someone else tidy them up and format them in DocBook or whatever, if you like, later, is great.
I mean, I think that, the wiki does lower the bar, but the bar's still way too high. I think if you look at people...
What? It's in the wiki?
Yes, because the wiki still requires you to have a knowledge of...
clicking edit.
No, have a knowledge of, for example, of a style guide.
Okay. Yeah, but
it's in four star. Ideally,
how are you going to get rid of that?
But
though?
But the point I'm making, from my
you
understanding
can't
of what Matt, from my understanding
writing
of what,
skills,
yeah,
you can't.
From my understanding of what Matt was saying, anyone can essentially edit stuff in the wiki, and then they've kind of got like a dedicated team who will take that content and they'll mark it up and
snapshot it
and they'll rewrite bits of it.
Yeah.
Now the problem that's a good way of doing things, but the problem with that is that there's a degree of there's an element of you're always rewriting stuff and you're always marking stuff up. So if you want to put something from one format into another format, you've got to fiddle with it.
Yeah,
now the point I'm making as an example, I mean, WYSIWYG editors are coming in, but they're essentially you write a bit of a text and then you select something and then you change it. What I want to see is when I see a web page on the internet, I want to actually be able to edit the text there and then. and things like that. I want the bar to be even lower.
But that'd be dead easy to do.
It would be, but the point is that, like you say, is that people are constantly coming up with new ways of doing things instead of actually the simplest way in writing documentation.
I think
documentation's still too difficult for people, because if you want to be a part of the core team that actually modifies other people's work, you've still got to know about subversions, you've got to know about different formats.
I don't agree with you.
Eh?
I don't agree with you. I mean, yeah, like Aid says, if what you want to do is just write documentation, I can't see why it would be important to be part of the core team. If you think, oh, I'm just going to write loads and loads of documentation, some other bugger can understand subversion, fine, who cares? Well, you know, just write loads of documentation.
I agree with you, but if you can lower that bar even further, then why not lower it?
And you're assuming there that there is a core team in place already, which there is with UDP.
But other projects there isn't.
Yeah, exactly.
Most projects do not work like the Ubuntu documentation project.
No, I mean, they're very efficient.
People have to actually write the documentation and make the formats themselves. And that's the problem with it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I can see the idea of making documentation as a concept a bit easier. But to be honest with you, if you're a project and you want to make it easy for people to document stuff, and we've taken the piss out of this view in the past, put up a wiki. You know, it will at least help people. The point is that you've got to be prepared to have a Matt East who's going to go through the stuff afterwards and turn it into real documentation. Don't just say the wiki is our documentation.
I'll give you one.
Use it as a way of receiving contributions. Enabling collaboration, but not, you know, it's the production area from which your documentation is created. It's not actually the documentation itself.
I think it's a series of fairly simple things. I'll give you an example. When I write Linux desktop hacks, like with any publisher, you get a template that you can use.
Available from all good bookstores, by the way.
Available.
I was just like with DHTML yeah, Utopia, by the way.
And
shill your
now,
book.
Now, when
I wrote an article today about marketing and open source projects. It's on my website.
This isn't a pimping session.
Would you write it in Vim?
Notepad plus plus.
anyway.
I did.
Anyway, point being made. When I wrote the Ubuntu guide, it was just a stock template. Essentially, it was just nothing much more than an OpenOffice template, right? And you type stuff in, and you had to have a certain knowledge of doing it. So when you have an image, for example, each image needs a caption. And that's the style guide, but you've got to manually add that caption, if you see what I mean.
This is in the Ubuntu guide.
This is for the Ubuntu book.
Oh, right.
Right?
Now, were many of the UDP team involved?
Matt East did some tech editing on it.
And Corey the Ubuntu, Berger.
Eh?
Corey Berger
was involved. And some of the, and Mako was involved and all the rest of it. But the point is that, with the O'Reilly book, as an example, when you add an image, it automatically puts a caption underneath
In Word.
Yes, it does. And we should, but the concept of automatically putting the caption there, there's nothing wrong with that. It does it, it's word specific, but the point is that it's making documentation easy, because then every person who writes documentation who adds an image, then it automatically adds
as
a figure caption, and it adds a figure, some figure text that you can replace.
As long as you're prepared to mandate that everyone writes their documentation in OpenOffice, or in your magic documentation tool.
Whatever that is, whether that's a glorified wiki, whether that's an OpenOffice, or OpenOffice, it doesn't really matter.
Well, I don't think that's a problem, though, because you would mandate that they write it in Python.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is slightly different, because you're demanding that they write in English. No, because you are making a technical demand of someone. For example, with Jacosha, you insist that they have the latest CVS GStreamer installed. So why not insist that they have a certain editor, even if it's a web-based
There's
one?
There's nothing wrong with making technical decisions about tools.
Because, to be honest, I mean, I've got no conceptual problem with that, but that means that either you mandate one style for all open-source documentation, or everyone writes their own documentation editor.
Or you make an easy way.
Or everyone writes their own documentation set of macros, say. So O'Reilly would have one, the UDP would have one set, and
the user data
and the Fedora project would have a different set, and so on. And that's a pretty heavy burden for whoever has to write the bastard,
but the point is that the person who writes the documentation, the ideal thing is that they just want to write words, and they shouldn't have to think about style. Whatever they're writing should figure out the style guide for them.
Who writes the macros that work the style out and enforce the style guide?
Yeah, whoever's involved in the documentation project. Whoever.
But that's what I'm saying. Isn't that quite a heavy burden? Because every project's going to have to write their own set, or say, we'll have documentation that looks like the UDP's documentation.
What's wrong with having the same style for everyone?
Having one style to rule them all.
Maybe you're able to change the colours and the logo and everything, but...
Yeah.
Because
but if something works, it works, isn't it?
Because if you,
international standards,
this could be an LSB thing.
If either you, Matt maybe or Jono, disagree with that documentation guy, would you go, no, I'm not gonna do it right,
just change
I'm gonna
the
do it
style.
Their way
surely
instead.
Surely there are coding standards though, when
No, that's the point. Anytime someone says everyone should do it this way, and if you do it any other way then you are wrong, somebody disagrees. About everything. About brace style in
what
C,
about
which
language. So you're basically disagreeing with all standardisation.
What about the Higg?
I'm disagreeing with trying to enforce standards across lots of different projects.
I never said across projects. Yes, you might have one macro per project.
But then someone has to write a macro per... Isn't that a waste of people's time?
Then have one macro across projects then.
Yeah, but that's the point. Then you're saying that either people have to waste loads of time, or you have to do your documentation the way the one guy in the middle thought of it.
But irrespective of whether you choose one way or the other, at the end of the day, it makes... it easier for people to contribute documentation. That's the primary goal.
But it makes it more difficult for people to set up an environment in which people can contribute documentation, because you have to write the macro set first before anyone can write
one
line
person,
of documentation.
One person writes the macro.
Yeah, but that's hard.
Is it?
Yes.
But that's like saying no one should ever write open source software because writing a programming language is hard. So we shouldn't bother doing that.
You don't write a programming language.
But we've got compilers, we've got interpreters coming out of our bloody ears.
We have done, yeah, because the open source way is someone goes, I think I'm going to write this now, but historically no one writes documentation, and no one's exactly stepping up at the moment to write loads of macro sets that aren't being used.
The point I'm making...
So you have to point to someone and say, you have to write a macro set now.
The point I'm making...
And people don't respond well to that.
The point I'm making is that, yes, it will require someone writing this macro. But I don't think that's a totally unreasonable claim, given the technical competence of the open source community. It might require, for example, someone who's a full-on coder, who's not in the doc team, writing it and contributing it to the doc team.
Stupid question, right? Publishers, O'Reilly have got a very, very comprehensive macro set.
Yeah.
SitePoint have got a not very comprehensive at all macro set, and it works in OpenOffice. And I think part of the reason that it isn't comprehensive is so it works in OpenOffice.
Right.
What about other publishers? Does everyone else have a really complicated thing, like O'Reilly? They put a lot of time and work and effort
into.
I didn't think so. So only O'Reilly have done it. And they're professional publishers who have to have these styles. Presumably it's more important for them than it is for, say, the Ubuntu documentation project. I don't know whether it is or not, but...
No, I think...
Or someone writing fiction.
Why haven't other publishers put the time and effort in?
Don't know. I mean, I'm assuming because a lot of publishers think, well, this is a responsibility of the author.
Or the editor, and any style-related stuff will be done by editing. Or the typesetter.
Certainly, SitePoint, the books that I wrote, SitePoint went through and made some changes to trick it up into SitePoint style afterwards, and presumably the O'Reilly people don't have to because the macros do it for them.
Yeah.
But then you lose the benefit of people being able to write tools, write documentation in Notepad++. You'd have to use OpenOffice.
Tell us what you think, people.
Okay, on the phone now we've got Gareth Bowker from the FSF Europe. Hello. Hi, Gareth.
Hi.
How you doing?
Good, thanks. How are you?
Not so bad. You're on the phone to the Lug Radio team.
Hello, everyone.
Right. Hi. Okay. First question. Are the FSF and the FSF Europe really relevant anymore?
Ooh! Straight in there.
Good question. Yes, I think they are. I mean, FSF has been going now since 1984-85, and has been obviously very instrumental in pushing free software throughout the world.
Right, okay.
You know, if you look at places like SourceForge or FreshMeat, there are tens of thousands of projects that are licensed under free software licenses.
Yes, yeah.
Organisations like FSF Europe, which is who I do work for, FSF Europe's been going now for just over 5 years.
Okay,
and
right.
FSF Europe's agenda is to push the message of free software within Europe, to defend the rights and freedoms of free software developers and free software users in Europe.
Right.
So a lot of the work that FSF Europe is doing is behind the scenes at levels like... European Commission, European Parliament, the UN, and so on.
Right.
So, although you might not actually see us day to day, and you know, see interviews with us on, you know, in the magazines or with people like yourselves, you know, FSF Europe in particular are working at very high sort of political levels.
Okay, I mean, the question wasn't totally nasty. The reason why I ask is. The FSF seem, you know, very important in terms of founding the system that we tend to use today, and that's something that Stallman tends to bang on about. But
increasingly, you know, the open source and the free software community is very large now, and there's lots of different organizations doing this, and the FSF Absolutely. Push it from a largely ethical angle, for which only certain people care about that side of things. So my, you know, do you find that the FSF are too ethical in some ways?
I think FSF and FSF Europe tend to try and target the areas that are going to be important in the future. So when FSF started, people like Richard Stallman and so on were developing free software because at the time there weren't that many people developing free software, or certainly not under licenses that that we now sort of consider to be entirely free. And as time's gone on, you know, the free software community has grown significantly.
Yeah, yeah.
And there are now, you know, tens of thousands of people developing free software around the world. So the role of Free Software Foundation as a free software developer has got a lot less. So the role of the FSF and FSF Europe has changed over time. You know, the areas that we're looking at are the areas that are going to affect free software in the future. So, you know, while we might not be as relevant perhaps now as we were 10, 20 years ago in terms of the software that people are using day-to-day on their computers, in terms of the actual code that's running on their computers, the sort of ethical, philosophical aspect of it is what we're trying to defend.
Right. So it sounds like you don't need to call it GNU/Linux then?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, the reason for calling it GNU/Linux is so that people continue to be aware of the fact that, the GNU system, as was sort of originally designed by Richard.
All hail.
Hang on a second. Sorry, my mouth's just gone very dry. Can you just excuse me for a second?
Sorry,
okay, that's all right.
Where were we?
We're just looking at GNU/Linux and if that was a good name for it. So should we start that question again?
Yeah, that'd be good.
All right, I'll do that then.
Okay.
So we don't really need to call it GNU/Linux then, do we?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I mean, the name GNU/Linux was basically, Richard was pushing the name GNU/Linux as a way to be aware of the fact that of the history and the heritage of free software. When people look at the name Linux, they see a kernel and operating system, and perhaps see more of the sort of open source side of things, without looking at the freedoms and the benefits that come with the sort of philosophical aspects of things.
Yeah, but shouldn't you guys just stick to what you're good at, which is talking to the European Commission rather than trying to get involved in branding?
Well, I mean,
kick it in, man. Sorry.
Well, the GNU/Linux name is something that FSF have come up with, and it's something that we believe in as well, which is why we use it when we're talking about GNU/Linux.
Well, I mean, God knows, we don't want to have a pop at you for something which is not actually the policy that you originated. A slightly different question then. You say you've been working at the top levels of the European Commission and stuff like that. Can you give us a couple of concrete examples of stuff the FSF Europe have accomplished? I mean, we all know what the FSF have done, but the FSF Europe, although you've been around for 5 years, I've only really heard of you quite recently. So can you give us a couple of real examples of stuff you've done?
Well, one of the big examples that most people will have heard of is the European Union versus Microsoft case, the antitrust case that's been going through the courts for the past 2 years. Now FSF Europe's been working with the Commission for a number of years now, trying to sort of defend the free software aspect of it. We put together a paper, I think it was in 2003, along with the SAMA project, describing how some of Microsoft's practices were harmful to the SAMA project in particular, but free software in general. And because of that, we were invited to join the court case.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, from then, we've been working with the European Union fairly closely on this case. You know, if you look at some of the other organizations who were working with the European Union, there are companies like Real, for example, and a bunch of other companies who were basically bought out. You know, Microsoft paid them off in order to leave the case. And FSF Europe has been there throughout, defending freedom, really.
Right, okay. I find the it interesting that there's the FSF and there's the FSF Europe, who, like Akka's just said, I haven't really heard that much about. So would you consider that the, you know, the FSF Europe is basically has the same views and opinions as the FSF?
Certainly very similar, yes.
Right.
I mean, I think the main difference between FSF and FSF Europe is more a sort of cultural issue. You know, FSF is very US centric, or at least has been historically. Right. If you look at GPLV2, it was written with a very sort of US legal framework in mind. FSF Europe tries to take the philosophy and the politics that FSF push and apply that to the Europe.
Right. I mean, the reason why I ask is that earlier in the week I sent an email to Richard Stallman inviting him to come on the show. Yeah. And he declined, and he said he declined because we refer to ourselves as an open source show.
Yeah.
He mentioned that we say that we're a Linux show as well, which I'm not entirely sure that we do, but we're obviously an open source show. And I just think it's interesting that he declined as the FSF. You're part of FSF Europe, yet you're happy to come on the show. And another guy we know, Shane McLaughlin, he's happy to talk to other people who use the words open source. So there seems to be something of a split there.
I don't think it's too much of a split. I mean, Shane actually works quite closely with FSF Europe as well. He's one of our fellows and has been working with me for the past few months. So I know Shane quite well. I think really the only real issues are perhaps sort of cultural differences, if you like. Although FSF Europe very strongly believe in talking about free software as opposed to open source and talking about GNU Linux rather than Linux, it's not really... We think that it's important to talk to people who are talking about Linux and open source and try to educate them, to make them aware of the history and the freedoms involved with it and so on.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that much of a split particularly.
Right. I suppose in some ways it's an inconsistent perspective for some people.
Yeah, I mean it is actually something that we've spoken to Richard about on a few occasions.
I can imagine the response that you got. Did he tell you something about enunciating your vowels?
He didn't mention it actually. It's difficult to by email.
one very, very quick question just before I hand it over to Matt, who I think is going to wrap it up. Mm-hmm. We know of you, and you're doing a talk at Lug Radio Live.
Yes.
Which, you know, we're very, very grateful for you to come along and help out with the day. And we know Shane.
Yep.
There seems to be some kind of death match going on in the Free Software Foundation Europe. Are you a harder man than him? Are you going to be the king of the FSF Europe?
Well, Shane has been, very much involved with Free Software Foundation Europe. I think we sort of complement each other very well. There's certainly no death matches going on between us or anything like that.
Oh, that's a shame. okay,
if there
just
were, who'd win?
Yeah, if there were, who'd win?
Oh, me definitely.
Yay! Just before we kind of finish everything off, do you think that it's useful to have someone like Richard Stallman as a figurehead for a movement, or do you feel that sometimes maybe you're weighed down by the baggage of having one person who's very strong in their views? Because I know that if I was a member of FSF Europe, Chris, I would get very frustrated by someone who wouldn't talk and spread the message just because of a simple matter of whether you stick GNU slash on the front of something. I mean, we were having a discussion the other day, maybe we should call it Sun slash Linux, you know, I mean, for God's sake, surely free software philosophy is more important than a bit of nomenclature.
Nice.
Well, I mean, that's something that, to a certain extent, I mean, you'd have to take that up with Richard, and I'm sure he'd have by email anyway.
But for you, though, on the show, though.
But for you, though, is it not frustrating that you have someone, I mean, obviously you guys have chosen to call yourselves Free Software Foundation Europe, you've sort of saddled yourselves with a lot of baggage there. Are you happy with that? I suppose you must be.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think one of the frustrating things that I found with Richard is actually, when you're discussing things with him by email, he's always right. as frustrating as it might be occasionally to have somebody who's so very staunch in his views, he's always thought those views through very, very strong, to a great degree. Mm-hmm. And the way that he comes up with his reasoning is very logical, very correct. And yeah, at the end of the day, the things that he's saying are things that we believe very strongly in. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't be called Free Software Foundation Europe for a start.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
We wouldn't be working so closely with FSF in a number of different areas.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, there are sort of a few minor things that we occasionally disagree on, but. For 99.9% of things, we're very much of the same opinion.
Fantastic. Gareth, thank you very much for coming on the show.
You.
We look forward to seeing your manly prowess at Lug Radio Live. Can you, just to wrap up, tell people how they can contact FSF Europe and how they can get involved in the UK wing of things?
Sure. There are a couple of ways. If you go to the FSFEurope.org website, then down the right-hand side, you can see a Get Active link. And it lists a number of ways that you can get active within FSF Europe. Also, just in terms of discussion, we've got a couple of mailing lists. There's a public FSFE-UK@GNU.org mailing list.
Right, right.
So if you go to lists.gnu.org and search for the UK, then you'll find us. And there's also UK@FSFEurope.org, which is a way of contacting people in the UK who are working with FSF Europe.
Excellent.
Excellent.
Or alternatively, just come along to Lug Radio Live and nab
yes,
me somewhere.
Indeed.
Yeah.
That's what we like.
Cheers, Gareth. Speak to you soon.
Bye. Thanks, Gareth. Bye.
Bye.
Cheers. Interesting interview.
Yes. I agree.
We've got to be careful, obviously, because... like anyone who represents an organisation, they don't make all of the decisions, particularly in somewhere like the FSF, which is very much top-down from Stallman.
Or the FSFE.
And the FSFE and the FSC. Separate organisation.
It was separate. But, I don't know, I just don't think they're particularly relevant anymore. I mean, they hammer on from...
When you say anymore, do you ever believe they were?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I do, yeah.
Right, okay.
I mean...
I just wanted to clarify
hang on,
that.
The FSF were relevant or the FSFE were relevant?
Well, you see, yeah, FSF, FSFE...
That's two very different things.
They are. But part of the problem is trying to get an idea of exactly what each one does. I mean, they're both, essentially... The impression he said was that the FSF are really FSF but for America, and FSF Europe are just for Europe, and we have geographical issues.
What he said was that it's a cultural thing. So I think what it is, in America, they say no to free software... FSF Europe say no.
And no.
Do they just take all the Z's out of the words and press them with S's? So organised becomes
but
organised.
Kind of, but the impression I got from him, though, was that they follow the FSF lead in terms of policy.
Yeah.
So they're not just like the European wing of the FSF. Or sorry, they're acting like the European wing of the FSF, although, according to them, they're separate organisations.
The thing I find interesting, though, is that if they essentially, you get the impression that Richard Stallman, who's obviously the main man behind it all, he's got a set of views, and people sympathise with those views, and they want to help the ambitions of the FSF and the FSF Europe, right?
Right, okay.
And Stallman has been so incredibly straight down the line, dogmatic, about not cooperating with things that go against his principles. Like I said in the interview, I invited him to come on this show, and I said, do you want to come on the show? And he said, no, because you've basically... You say you're an open source podcast, and he won't even come on. And we talk about free software every single time, right? And he won't come on the show. The thing I find amazing is that people
would he have come on the show if we'd called it the GNU/Lug Radio?
I think if we talked about free software all the time, he'd come on, no problem. But the thing is,
he didn't ask us to call it GNU/Lug Radio, right?
No.
Okay.
But the thing I find interesting is that for someone who's so like dogmatic in his views. How can people like Sean McLaughlin and
Gareth Bowker.
Sorry, Shane and Gareth Bowker. How can they be associated with the FSF and Stallman and be happy with that? Because they're much more moderate. I don't understand how Stallman accepts that.
I don't know. I mean,
surely there's just going to be a load of Stallmans.
Gareth, so, as long as they call it GNU/Linux, I don't think he cares.
Ridiculous.
Gareth said there that he and the FSF Europe agree with 99.9% of the views of the FSF. That's a pretty high correlation there. This is not just occasionally paying lip service to what Stallman thinks.
But why don't they follow the same principles as Stallman is what I'm interested in.
Who's saying they don't?
Well, the fact that he's on the show.
Yeah.
Oh, right. Well, I just think it's because Stallman is, for want of a better word, an unusual example of the way that someone deals with things that they don't agree with. You know, most people accommodate other things, but this guy will refuse to compromise to such an extent that even if he has a prime opportunity to spread his message...
Who does this sound like?
He refuses to do it.
Everyone looks at Ack.
I thought I might get some kind of kick in there. That seems a bit unreasonable.
But that's the thing. That's the thing. Stallman is so unrelenting in his views.
That
yet,
he's biting his off his nose to spite his face.
Yeah. So the reason why he didn't come on the show, I think, was because the reason why he didn't come on the show was because he stopped doing impressions of biting someone's nose off.
Oh, I was trying to do an impression of biting your own nose off, which I thought was a bit of a challenge. What did he do? Did he stand on a chair or something?
How does that help?
Stallman.
How would standing on a chair help you bite your own nose off?
Whilst combing his hair in the mirror.
Idiot. Like. Stallman didn't come. The reason why he didn't come on the show, I don't think it was because of some tiny little thing like he thought, oh, I can't be bothered, or they kind of disagree with that. I think it was a very real principle. And I don't understand how other members of FSF Europe are necessarily
affiliates
accepted.
Yeah.
Because when they go against his core principles, that's the kind of thing I don't understand. They're so incredibly inconsistent. It's kind of like someone from Microsoft going, yeah, I absolutely love open source and free software. Everybody should use it. Don't use Windows. It's totally incompatible with their viewpoint.
There's a bit of a difference there.
I don't think it is. I think it's principles that depend on the organisation.
There are two important points there. First of all, and I don't want to have to stress this again, but the FSF and the FSF Europe are not the same organisation. So,
but the FSF
Stallman doesn't get to say you can't join the FSF Europe because it's bugger all to do with him.
Yeah, but I agree.
And secondly, Microsoft do have a guy who at least partially says, yeah, use open source, Bill Health.
He doesn't say use open source.
No, that's not
He doesn't say that at all. Yeah, he analyses. He does competitive analysis.
They look for business opportunities.
Okay. He doesn't stand up and promote the use of open source software.
Okay.
He looks at how Microsoft can work with them. And that's the thing. Yes, they're FSF Europe, but if they don't at least share some of these principles, and they say they shared 99.9% of the principles, it just seems incompatible. And
surely the only principle that they don't share is that they will come onto a program that doesn't call itself GNU/LugRadio.
Yeah, that's bad.
Surely
bad
that is
all
the only
we've found,
thing,
isn't it?
The only inconsistency we came across.
Possibly, I'd say, but I don't know. I get the impression from talking to Sean, I keep forgetting his
Shane.
Yeah, Shane and Gareth, is that I get the impression that they're much more moderate, willing, you know, much more kind of flexible in terms of their issues. They've got principles, but they're flexible on their issues. More flexible than the FSF. And more than 0.1% of the FSF.
Is that not a matter of the fact that they've, without wishing to, you know, disparage anyone, if that's a word.
Disparage.
Is that not just because they've got some social skills and they know how to deal with people?
I think
is it
might
pragmatism
be,
at the end of the day?
I think it might be pragmatism based on the fact that no one knows who the FSF Europe are.
That's twice
and,
now, John.
And so, you know, they've got to do something to elevate their profile a bit. Stallman can afford to be dogmatic about it because everyone knows who he is anyway. I don't know whether he was this dogmatic when he originally came up with the idea with the GNU concept. Maybe he was.
Mm.
But he may have been more accommodating at that point because he, in the same way that they used a proprietary C compiler to write the first version of GCC because they had to. And they did have to, and he's been quite clear about that. You know, you use it until you don't have to anymore. Maybe he was more accommodating towards people not calling... there wasn't a GNU/Linux there, but be more accommodating in general. But now he doesn't have to be. The FSF Europe, on the other hand, are in the position Stallman was 20 years ago. They're trying to elevate their profile so that they can go on and do good work.
That's an interesting point. You're saying that they're in the position he was in 20 years ago, but 20 years ago, GNU had a point. The FSF, you know, Stallman actually had something to rally against back then. Now there's a whole support network, and I wonder if we need the FSF Europe.
The FSF and the FSF Europe's argument, at least partially, is that they're still rallying because open source is not free software, and therefore they're rallying against... I mean, yes, open source is closer to free software than proprietary software was.
But nowhere near free enough.
But it's still something to rally against because people aren't doing it for the reasons of freedom. They're doing
really
it for the reasons of being able to get at the source.
Really important question. How much of what we talk about and what we use is open source as opposed to free software? I bet it's
virtually nothing. I can honestly say I have no idea.
I agree with you. Their point is the stress that people place on it. It's because people aren't doing it for the reasons of freedom.
How do they know that, though? I'm doing it for the reasons of freedom, but I call it open source because it's so much easier than having to say, oh, it's free as in liberty, you know, as in like I'm allowed to stand in Hyde Park Corner.
But that's the point. They get so wound up about the most ridiculous of things. Exactly. I mean, the GNU/Linux thing. I mean, you know, I'm an open source advocate, or a free software advocate, depending on which way you want to say it.
Mm.
And I think there's much better things you can spend your time on. I spend my time on certain things, and other advocates spend their time on certain things, and they all seem to get so wound up about ridiculous levels of branding.
You see, right, I'm going to illustrate this with a point. At the moment, Jono is wearing a developer t-shirt.
Yes.
Right? Now, every one of us, the other three of us, independently have said, Jono, nice Microsoft t-shirt you've got on there.
Yep.
And Jono has very clearly expressed the fact that it's not a Microsoft t-shirt. It's run by Microsoft Communities, totally different organisation.
Yes.
Why don't you just go, oh, okay, I'm wearing a Microsoft t-shirt? Why be dogmatic about stressing the difference between the two? Because that's in microcosm what I think the FSF are doing.
No. I think there's a difference. There's a difference between if you say to me that's a Microsoft t-shirt, it's fine for me to correct you, right? But if every time you refer to this t-shirt and you said it's a Microsoft t-shirt, I was absolutely dogmatic about correcting you, and I correct you about the tiniest little things to do with this t-shirt.
And you wouldn't go to his house if he didn't accept that it wasn't a Microsoft
t-shirt.
Is it a Microsoft t-shirt?
I wouldn't even speak to other people. I wouldn't wear other t-shirts, you know. That's the difference, is that they're just too far, they're too extreme.
Is that a Microsoft t-shirt?
Is this a Microsoft t-shirt?
Yeah.
I told you earlier on.
Yes. It isn't.
Bite the fat one, young man.
As if you'd said that if we hadn't just had that conversation. But I mean, I think that's the point. In microcosm, I mean, you could have just said, the second time, someone said something, you'd have thought, okay, fine, I corrected someone else about it being a Microsoft t-shirt, whatever, I'd just accept it. But it's important to make the point.
It is important.
And it's important to them to make the same point.
It's important for them to make the point, but I suppose, I don't know, there's priorities in terms of... There's bigger things challenging free software today than whether it's GNU/Linux.
We've talked a lot about iCandy in the past.
We have indeed.
Yes. And I've seen quite a few macOS X people say that there's no way they'd even consider Linux until someone in the open source community gets some kind of idea about design.
Mm.
And whatever, yeah. Mm. So the question is this: should someone take a Linux distribution, whichever one, don't care, Ubuntu, Fedora, whatever, and fork it and just work on making it look pretty? Don't care about putting in zero conf or making the file manager more usable, or which applications you use. Just take it and just make it look really pretty, and that's they do. With the intention of getting who care about design on board.
Is your intention to get a load of kilt-wearing maniacs starting using Linux?
Basically, yes.
What's the point, though, if you've got to develop a special live CDs do it, because when they actually come to use a distro that they really want to, all that stuff won't be there.
Yeah, but it shows them that it can actually be done.
This is why you, first of all, it shows you can actually be done. Secondly, those changes can filter back into the real distribution. And thirdly, importantly, it's based on Fedora Core 5, say. So it's not as if it's totally useless apart from the iCandy.
I think the most...
They just don't concentrate on making it any better in terms of anything other than iCandy. I mean, the macOS people are going to say, but we've got usability as well. You know, and whether that's better than Linux or not is a different argument, but the Vista people have obviously put in a lot of effort into making Vista look pretty. Whether you think they've succeeded or not is a different question.
I think the important thing is that, taking for example, everyone talks about XGL and AIGLX.
AIGLX is the one to go for.
Taking those two as an example, they are at the moment fairly difficult to set up on most distributions. With SUSE Linux Enterprise Desktop. Enterprise desktop. that's, you know, obviously that comes with it. But for most people, it's hard work. And the benefit is that if I could, like, plonk in a live, and I know there are live CDs to do this sort of thing, that's specific for getting all the iCandy set up, it means that people can test it en masse and submit bug reports and help out and express opinion about it instead of an elite few of developers, I think.
I'm not just suggesting that you have a live CD, you can demo it to people. I'm suggesting you make it a real installable distribution they should use.
Oh, okay.
It's not just, just for demos. It's
You'll have a hard disk installer.
Like so someone takes, for example, Ubuntu.
Yeah.
And they take, let's say, stock Dapper, but they basically max out the bling to 11.
They fork Dapper.
Right.
And call it whatever you like. You know, you don't have to use the word Linux in it if you don't want to.
Dappers.
Rebrand it something completely different. And just and construct on just making it look pretty. when Eft comes out, when Edgy comes out, then you might want to merge all the stuff in from Edgy. In the same way that when a new version of Debian comes out, the Ubuntu people merging the Debian versions of packages. But you build it on top of Ubuntu. You don't necessarily try and make it an Ubuntu project. Don't even think about the word Linux. Don't try and appeal to the free software community. Try and appeal to a different bunch of people. People who think that it looking pretty is important. Whether you think those are Mac users now or whether that's not the case.
Make it appeal to superficial people.
I think we would all agree that there are a group of people who are more interested in how stuff looks than how it actually works. Who you think those people are is another question entirely. Right, and I don't want to cast any aspersions at anybody in particular, but I'm sure there are people like that. Why not get them on board with Linux?
I'd like to see something.
Why do you want them on board?
Because then there's more users of Linux.
And that's it, full stop.
Basically, yes.
I think. So you don't really care on the quality of the users, you just want more users.
If you've got more users, then you get things like more support for video cards. And you get video card manufacturers who will release Linux drivers.
I don't think you should ever judge people on the quality of users.
Yeah, I mean, we're not fucking Dr. Engels.
That becomes elitist at that point.
Yeah.
And that's a bad thing. And depending on your view, I know you think differently, eh? But
no, I probably didn't word it very well, but I see what you mean.
I think one of the
AIDS Club.
I think one of the problems we have with Linux stuff at the moment is that that hardware support's a bit ropey. Now, the kernel people at least partially think that you shouldn't necessarily get drivers off of the people who make the hardware because they don't do it as well as the kernel people, which is fair play, but then there's a 2-year time lag. And the only way you can get people to pay more respect to Linux, port more applications to Linux, and port more drivers to Linux is by having more Linux users.
I think what I'd like to see is what I'd like to see is not so much entirely new distributions, but for example, I've been playing with Xgel recently, and I think it's xgel.compiz.net or something like that. This guy set up a Debian package repository with a bunch of updated packages. I'd like to see you easily be able to add, let's say, using Ubuntu as an example, a package repository, and then it installs a load of stuff.
It blings you up.
That blings you up.
You see,
but there's the same sort of thing. What's that thing for multimedia where just you run the one script and it just puts all multimedia stuff into Ubuntu?
That sort of thing, but the ability to turn that on and off. You know, because then you can do it to your, you know, kind of like package profiles. I'd like to be able to say, install Xgel from these people, and then it upgrades everything. But if I don't want it, be able to press a button and downgrade it.
I personally don't think so. I think if you brand it as, you can take Ubuntu Linux and then make it look bling, people won't think about it the same way. That sort of technique won't work to market the sort of people you're thinking of. Here is a product which looks really bling. And if they ask the question, you say, yes, it's based on Ubuntu Linux.
Why not just make Ubuntu bling?
Because not everyone, maybe we should do that, but I think what the Ubuntu people are concentrating their efforts on is more important. I think usability is more important than Blink. Yeah.
And they've got things like...
But not everybody does.
Do you know, I think it's quite deceptive to say, let's call it something else that nobody realises that it's based on Ubuntu Linux, and then just tell them that if they ask. That's quite deceptive.
It is quite deceptive. But I don't think that the, this is Linux, use it argument will work for every member of the population.
You say about that it's better that Ubuntu concentrate on usability, but the bling and or eye candy, let's use that term, and usability aren't mutually exclusive, are they?
No, of course not, no.
No, but I think there is a level of bling you could put on to make it look cooler and make it appeal to people more, which isn't particularly usable, it's just bling.
I think the problem...
XGL is remarkably good for usability.
It really definitely helps. Aids usability, much more than I ever thought when I first heard about it. I think the problem, though, Ak, is that if we just create new distributions of this sort of thing, A, it makes more distributions so people have got more choice, which is a good and a bad thing depending on your perspective. But I think the other thing is that you're talking about essentially taking a full-on operating system, blinging it up, and it becoming their proper operating system. And I think people are less likely to use... kind of a spin-off version of a distribution than the actual distribution itself, which is part of the reason why I'm saying I think you should be able to support, like, essentially package, you know, profiles or something like that.
That's exactly my argument as to why you don't say this is Blingbuntu. You don't say this is Ubuntu, but with Bling.
Would you say it's Ubuntu Bling Edition or something?
No, I wouldn't. I'd say this is Blingos.
Ubuntu Plus.
That's what I'd say. This is Blingos. You should use Blingos.
So it's a complete, as in, so it's a bit like CentOS and Red Hat.
Yeah, essentially. It's totally rebranded. The fact that it's Ubuntu under the covers. I mean, yes, we've accused Linspire of doing this to some extent, and I think it is deceptive if you're trying to appeal to the community. Yeah, but it's the same thing as the Zandros people, and to some extent, I agree with what the Zandros people are doing, and to some extent, I didn't. I think them doing the whole C drive and D drive thing was bad because it kind of concealed the truth of the matter. Yeah. But on the other hand, I can see why they did it. And it's a similar kind of argument.
It'd be nice to have a CD that just showcased, you know, what can be done.
The reason I bring this up is because that's something that people who are not Linux hackers could conceivably contribute to. And ordinarily, you'd say, you know, because you can't just say, let's take a group of free software hackers and make them work on something else instead. It doesn't work like that. But there's a whole group of designers and people out there who aren't currently involved in free software. And you can't say get involved in Ubuntu, because I said, let's bling this up and people will say no. Or let's add this kind of design to it, and people say, no, that doesn't fit in because it doesn't work on FreeBSD or whatever. You just don't care about that. Make a bling on
it. Spinning it on its edge a little bit, I think that one of the greatest things that we've got is the ability to do this
3D
sort of
edge.
Nice 3D edge. Yeah. I think the fact that we can do this kind of thing is one of the greatest assets that we've got with open source, and it's kind of cohesive with today's IT world.
I can hear background music while you're speaking there, John.
So, for example, you know, we're technical people, and we've got an interest in computers, and each of us have got more than one computer, right? And we've got things like VMware that we can install more than one operating system. Installing more than one operating system is not uncommon nowadays. Mm-hmm. It used to be a few years ago. So the idea of having lots of different distributions, some that you can play with, some that you don't play with, some that you use for serious work, really is a good thing. And obviously this is the thing where we're kind of unique over the competition. So I think it's interesting. I think we should encourage this sort of thing.
Right, on to the emails.
Emails!
Got an email from Ola, and he's talking about Ola. Picasa.
Picasa!
He said, hi, in the latest show, you didn't seem so positive about Google Picasa.
Yep.
And I just want to add my 2 cents to the discussion. I've been using Picasa in Windows for quite some time, and I think it's a good tool. I've managed all my photos, and that means I've, of course, put tags on, etc., for everything. So this is very important to me, that I can continue to use Picasa.
Or anything else which supports Picasa's open export format. Sorry, yeah, carry on.
Of course, if Picasa was open source and worked well with my desktop, GNOME, Windows, KDE, then it'd be even better. But imagine if Google actually puts lots of work into Wine. It makes it possible to use other applications via Wine with your desktop. That would be good for me. Brilliant. I see this the same way as it's important to use... Hang on in a minute. Let me just read that again. I see this in the same way as I see that it is important for Linux to be able to handle DRM-protected records.
Right, okay.
Because if a company wants to use DRM, they should be able to use DRM, and Linux should be able to play this music. Open source for me is about being able to choose whatever I want to, so I should be able to choose not to use pure open source techniques if I want. Right. That's just my few cents worth. Thanks for a brilliant show. Hola.
That's freespire.org.
Just a tiny side point. Sebastian!
He wrote in before.
Samin.
I remember him.
said that, he wrote in about Picasa as well and said that, now let's use the Lug Radio Force to open source this thing. So,
I don't really care if it is open source. I know I said that last time, but I just don't care.
Well, I think it'd be nice to have another piece of open source software.
Yeah, I suppose.
And Google, come on!
Google!
You know, let's have a go at this thing. So, Matthew P. Revell.
Right, I've got an email here from Mark Johnson, otherwise known as Port 7.
Port 7, doing
says,
a boff.
I'm trying to pull off this boff.
Ah.
The idea of the boff is to help those who want to contribute to Floss, but don't know how.
Floss.
It's going to be on Sunday between 12 and 1 p.m. at Lug Radio Live, I would assume.
Right.
Yes. so if people could email him, Port 7, that's 7 spelt as a word, @gmail.com, port7@gmail.com, and let him know what sort of things they would like to see in the boff, and also if they could help out. He's ideally looking for small packages of work that people could do easily and quickly, so giving them instant gratification and a good intro into the whole thing. So get on to Mark Johnson.
And if anybody else is doing a boff at Lug Radio Live, do let us know so we can pimp it on the show. Because we obviously want your boff sessions to be very, very good. we've had an email from one David Marley. Who's a local.
Man of cardigans.
In these parts.
Man of cardigans. Does he have cardigans?
All the time.
Oh yeah, he does, doesn't he? He has Blue Peter
Wild,
jumpers.
Wild, crazy cardigans. He says, how about asking Mr. Shuttleworth if he would be prepared to put up a prize of one free LPI/Ubuntu certification exam for a winner of a competition at LaGrange
Live. Well, so you don't have to sit it, you just get the certification.
Wicked!
Is that the prize? An honorary doctorate.
Why don't we just hand them out when people get in?
Yeah.
Be like MSCFY.
Enterprise.
Chris Waddle. Anyway, he says, with the pre-release of your Ubuntu book as second prize, and maybe a book voucher from O'Reilly as third prize. He says, keep up the good work. Ging Avenger with the ever loyal Beard Boy at his side.
I'm the Ging Avenger. Wicked.
I'm the ever loyal Beard Boy.
I'm assuming you're talking about me there, by the way.
Yeah. Or listening to you lot behind. And fight against the evilness that is bald, short, and angry. So Matt's two people.
Nice.
Oh, no, no.
And you two are evil as well.
Against both of us, by the sounds of it.
He says, from Merley.
Why is he fighting against us, by the way?
I don't know.
Because you're evil, by the sound of it. I'm not quite sure why, but there you go.
But do you understand most of the stuff that comes out of Merley's mouth?
I've got a suggestion for him.
Get a job!
Nice!
Get a job, Pikey Sky fan.
That's not very nice now, is it? Email from a chap called Connor McDermott. He says, you might be interested about some benchmarking of Ubuntu on the new Spark boxes done by Col MacArthur.
These free ones?
I applied.
Yes.
Right?
And are you playing with your new server?
No, wait. Tip for you people. It asks you for, like, your name and address and stuff. And then there are four questions in there, which say, think with...
Like credit card
details. No. They're four yes or no questions.
Okay.
And one of them was something like, do you want a Sun server for free? And you went, yes. And then one of them was, do you think you'd like to use over 4 gigabytes of RAM? And I said, no, not being able to think of anything at all. I can do with that much memory. No, hang on. Okay. Right? And then one of them was, are you likely to do development on it? And I said, yes. And then there was another one, which was something else that I didn't think I needed. So I said, no. Got through the process. And then it said, oh, now you've answered no to some of these questions, so it'll have to be reviewed by a person.
Imagine that.
Which means that, people, if you want one of those free Sun servers, it looks like it's all free and clear and above board, and I spoke to one of the Sun people on the online chat thing, and I said, it's all free, it costs me no money, you'll come and pick it up for no money, you're not going to trick me into it and go, oh, the letter didn't arrive, pay us 10 grand. And he said, no, it's all free and legit and above board, so if you guys want to go and do it, go and do it,
tick
but
yes
answer
to
yes to all the questions.
Now, bald man, I fucking told you so, didn't I?
Well, let's see what happens. I was really, really hoping I could come along to this episode of Lug Radio and then go, yeah, and I've been playing with it for the last week, suck on this bald man. But disappointingly, the question thing said no. I did debate going through and filling in all the answers again. But I thought they might get a bit wise.
Baldman exerts a certain amount of suspicion about this free Spark thing. I think you thought you were going to be sent to Guantanamo Bay.
Well, no, well,
never ever believe
it. In the Baldman's defence, I don't yet have a free Sun server. But Mr. Phipps, if you're listening to this, you might want to accelerate my process a bit because no one has yet contacted me. So presumably, you don't actually want me to have it.
The Phipp man cometh.
Anyway, Conor McDermott says that Col MacArthur has been. Benchmarking Ubuntu on the new Spark boxes. He's an Apache committer, and he's written loads of stuff at stdlib.net /squigglyline colmmac.
Stdlib?
stdlib.net.
Sexually Transmitted Disease slash, Library.
/colmmac, which is C-O-L-M-M-A-C-C. He's written quite a lot of stuff there, but one of the interesting things is he's managed to get Apache and Ubuntu on a T2000 to outperform Apache and Solaris on
isn't
a T2000.
T2000 one of the Terminator robots?
No, it isn't one of the Terminator robots, no. Shut up.
You look just like my Spanish teacher. That
he says, just thought you'd like to know. Thank you very much for that.
Yeah,
that
is a Spanish teacher. Thank you. Looks like a T2000.
Did he do that bit where he dissolved into all mercury and went through doors?
No, he had a few weeks off with a bad back, though.
Okay, Lord Scott Fitzgerald, Everitus Professor of History at Oxford, writes
Lord
in.
Scott what?
Fitzgerald.
Not just Scott Fitzgerald, then.
Oh, actually, you spotted it. It actually was just Scott
not
Fitzgerald.
Not F. Scott
and Gerald Fitzscott.
Anyway, he writes in. He said he wants to write in to say that Lug Radio is some of the best content on podcast.
Fantastic.
Not that he uses an iPod. He prefers to burn the CD. I'm speaking right into it, Jono.
I'm trying to get Aid to speak a bit louder. It sounds really quiet in here.
Really?
Yeah.
Maybe you should twiddle your knobs.
It's your dulcet tones.
He burns a show to CD.
He burns a show to CD.
But they're longer than a CD. How does he manage that?
Hence my comment earlier. he listens to them when he's driving to and from work. He got recommended to the show at his PC user group, Linux Special Interest Group, and quickly discovered that the only other radio show that he likes better is Binary Revolution, which caters to the hacker. type.
Hacker types. One of which is going to be at Lug Radio Live.
Yeah,
What's his name? Belial or whatever his name is?
Belial.
Yeah.
Hacker voice radio guy. He's going to be doing a lightning talk.
I'm really pleased that we've got him doing a talk, you know.
Is he from America?
No. It's UK thing.
Bilston.
He's going to be doing a talk.
Is he really from Bilston?
No, from Bilston, is he? Just guessing.
What do I say?
What do I say? We like
he's
a pie.
He's from London somewhere, isn't he?
London town.
Yeah, London.
Yeah.
Does he win? The London 2600 group.
He's going to be Lambeth walking all the way up the M6.
there with his Pearly King jacket on.
He's coming up for the Friday as well, so we have a few beers on the Friday as well.
Pride, not let him pride.
Not let him near any computers.
Right, shut up. Okay.
Carry on, Ravel.
Mr. Ben Thorpe has emailed us.
We know that name.
Yep. He says, firstly, ooh, Betty, it's Richard Stallman, move on.
Do you think?
Okay, you'll notice there isn't one in this episode.
We very figured we might have flogged it a little too hard.
I need to keep here. Anyway.
For free.
Secondly, Jesus, he was interested in a small segment on open source software in the BBC's Working Lunch programme. If you go to the forums, then you will see that Mr. Ben has posted the link there. And he says he wondered whether you had any thoughts on the usage of this term and other terms... as open source software, Libre software, Floss. So, you know, is this a problem of proper advocacy rather than terminology? Should we basically be saying free software or open source? Which goes back kind of to what we were saying earlier.
And about the free FSF.
And, I think it's a debate that we should have
some
in
of the
a
time.
Longer segment.
Yeah. I think we should dedicate some time to that in another show.
Yeah. He says he'd like, be interested in our views on Tremulous. It says everything's
it's a crap film, isn't it?
If only I had time to play games.
Everything's GPL'd, but the only part of the game that wasn't developed in open source was the engine. So there's a turn up for the books, isn't it?
It is a little bit, to be honest.
Remarkable reversal of the normal state of affairs.
You know, it says, what do we think about that? Well, don't know, really. Sorry, Miss Ben.
None of us are really game players. I mean, I play lots of G-planarity, if that counts.
G-what?
G-planarity. It's this game where you have to, like, drag circles around and they're all joined up with lines. It's
God,
wicked.
That sounds dreadful.
Yeah.
Fortunately, Aid get on the forums and he says,
is that what he says?
This. It is a mere 6 weeks from Lug Radio Live. Massively excited. Can't wait to see you and the rest of the community again. It's going to rock.
It's going to be cool.
It most certainly will.
And Mr. Ben asked us to bring something up.
Yes. He mentioned, you know, we've done some cool things in the Lug Radio community. We've achieved some interesting things, open source and various closed source things.
We did fix a clipboard there for a while.
We did. And
it's broken again.
The Lug Radio community came together as well, to help with Jacosha. And he says, you know, we've been talking about 3D graphics a lot.
Yep.
And why aren't people contributing to the open source graphics card project thing? So there's a lot of people listening to this show. And if you've got any kind of mathematical knowledge or you think you can contribute to that project, go and help. Because, you know, it really is quite a bottleneck in the open source system. So... we could do with...
Do we have a URL on us?
We don't.
Okay. I could put one in the show notes.
I think it's opengraphics.org.
Something
open
like that, yeah.
Project.org. Just go to Firefox and type in open graphics project.
Yeah.
And hit go.
Or type in Timmy.
And yeah, I think it's a good thing.
A couple of quick concession requests for Lug Radio Live here.
Did we agree them?
Well, we get the chance now. One from Dave Murphy, Schwack. Who says that he still owes us all beer from Linux World a couple of years ago, so I think he
does.
And that's in
£3 a small bottle beer as well.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, you're not wrong. So what we lose on his door contribution, we're going to gain on some free beer.
That's
free as in beer. So yes, Dave, you can have a concession. And one from Tom Shutt. Who wants a concession for lots and lots? Don't laugh at his name.
On my chest.
For goodness sake. Right. The reasons he wants a concession, he likes Python and Ubuntu.
Oh, we're going to give him one then.
Good. And it says here, cue boos and jeers from certain Bal faction. So well done for living up to your reputation there. Well done. And he knows a very strange and generally socially maladjusted guy from college called Dave. And he spent an hour sitting through a John O'Bacon presentation, so I think that gets him in shape, definitely.
He's clinched it on the last one.
Well
then,
said, yes, you can get in for a concession price.
He just keeps on winning, doesn't he?
You can see the next stage on the John O'Bacon tour.
We've had a mail from Joseph C. Tennies.
What?
He's Joseph C. Tennies. Amazing.
I'd like a tinny, mate.
Oh, tinny, I'm
can you see any tinnies?
He says, he sent a mail about wine versus libwine. Who groaned? Was it you, Bal?
It might have been me, yeah.
He says, I think people should really look into the differences between Wine and Libwine. Wine is the program that can read and run native Win32 executables. Okay. It then parses them and dynamically links them against Libwine re-implementations of the Windows libraries. Libwine is a library that can be used to quickly port applications from Windows to Linux. It is API compatible with Windows, and you'll therefore get a stable API. You also end up with an ELF binary, as opposed to a GNOME binary or a midget binary.
No.
Plus,
if you're going to say an ELF binary as opposed to a GNOME binary, that's really confusing. Don't do that.
Well, I'd have thought that the midget binary might have clarified the gag. It basically has made the Windows API a cross-platform library. Shut up. A cross-platform library with an open-source implementation. I'd personally love to see people figure out a way to make new look and feels for Wine, like what Mono has done with mono.windows.forms, which I thought was systems.windows.forms. But I agree, I'd love to see Windows applications running in Wine look more, bit more native. It's impossible completely, but...
Okay.
Aid stares at Johnny.
If you say so.
Yeah, so...
Excellent.
Lug Radio Live. Okay. Let's update people on that.
No, what Guardek. Happens before Lug Radio Live?
Ah, Guardek.
Yes. Lug Radio team are on tour.
We are.
A world tour, really, you can think about it.
We are, yeah. One day.
It's a week.
It is. It's a week long, you know.
Yeah. We tour from here to Barcelona and then back home again.
It's around the world, isn't it?
Yeah, we're going to go out. We've been asked to be the official media partners or something at Guardek, the GNOME European user and developer conference in Europe.
Does that mean we just go over there, drink loads of free beer?
There's an element of beer drinking involved.
No, we go over there and pay for loads of beer and then record some segments and talk to lots of people.
And not only can you hear the Lug Radio team, unfortunately, Matt won't be able to make it, although maybe he can change that, depending on... we're not going to put him under the hammer, but hopefully Matt can maybe get over, but if not, whatever.
nice!
Matt just sits there and looks knackered again. And he's nearly dead, apart from anything, aren't
I can't breathe very well tonight. I've lost my inhaler.
He's lost his inhaler, which is not good. But not only are the Guardek going to have Lug Radio there, but two members of the Lug Radio team are going to be presenting, aren't we?
Well, yeah. Jono's doing an actual proper real presentation up on the main stage, talking about Jacosha, which is fantastic. And I should be spending 5 minutes showing Jackfield to people who are lots cleverer than me.
I think you're undermining Jackfield. Jackfield's remarkably cool.
But it's going to be cool. So if you're going to be at Guardek, come and watch me demonstrate Jackfield.
But you're part of Jacosha as well.
Well, yeah, but it's John Patrick.
well, not really.
I saw it earlier, and it was absolutely amazing, by the way.
Jacosha is amazing, and I wrote all the hard bits.
Yeah.
Laszlo, who has actually written all the hard bits, just exploded by while listening beer. To this. Jackfield is Apple's dashboard for Linux, in that it actually runs dashboard widgets. And when I say it runs dashboard widgets, I mean it runs about 5% of dashboard widgets at the moment, but I'm working on it.
That project got canned.
It did get canned, because I was... too busy. But then I decided that it was a really important project and I need to get back to it, and so I blackmailed myself into getting back to it by...
How do you blackmail yourself?
By saying I'd do a lightning talk at Guardek, and I thought if I do that then I can't go back on it and bottle out and do something else.
It's really cool though, because I'm actually going to see one of your projects finish.
Shut up!
You start so many things and I think they're really good projects and they never get finished yet.
Hang on, Sparks hasn't walked into the room. how is Harsh. Dashboard really important?
I think dashboard's a very good project.
Really?
Yes,
I do. It's a pointless weather widgets.
No, it's not just a pointless load of weather widgets.
He's just
saying
what we're thinking.
There are lots and lots of widgets. Now, some of them are Apple specific, but I think it's a neat way to not only get loads of pointless widgets, if you like, but lots of really useful widgets that people have developed, and it gives us this whole massive, big, long stack of applications, mini widget applications, but applications nonetheless. That already exist. It's like writing Wine, except a lot easier.
It's filling in the gaps as well. It's another thing that we can run.
And therefore we can do it. And I can imagine loads of individual GNOME applications. I think the idea of having widgets pop up is actually quite a good one.
Mm.
I thought Dashboard was quite a good project when Apple came up
with it. It is useful as well. I think, you know, particularly for little things like calculators and things like that, you can just bring them in and use them quickly.
Well, that's the sort of plan I've got with it, really. I mean, I've got to actually write some more of it, and Guardic's only in 2 weeks, so I'm shitting myself.
All written in the mighty Python, yeah?
It is all written in Python.
Well, finish in two weeks then, right?
To be honest with you, an awful lot of it is JavaScript.
Where do you find the time to do things like this?
At 2 o'clock in the morning.
Exactly. Always on the internet that time.
Not going to bed until 2 o'clock in the morning, then getting up again at seven. Is where I find time for it.
Incidentally, regular listeners of the show, over the past couple of years will have heard the name Robert Love popped up, many a time, and we've often credit him as being an incredible guy. Ack was a particular fanboy for quite some time.
I was, because Project Utopia is brilliant. Yeah. Now he's less, he appears to have dropped off the scene a bit, because everyone just uses Project Utopia and thinks, well, that's
part and parcel
everything
of life.
Just works now, great.
Well, I'd like to revoke that reputation.
Oh!
Because he's speaking at the same time as me at Guardek.
No.
So come and talk about Chikosha. Who cares about network manager? We've seen all that shit before, it's good. Yep. But come and see the Chikosha talk.
You realise here that the bacon is well terrified. Everyone's going to go and watch the network manager talk, and there's going to be me sitting in the Chikosha.
I'm absolutely. Fuck off. I'm absolutely terrified because it's like really. But everyone loves network manager, and everyone wants to. I was up against network manager and Beagle, and I was thinking there's going to be like an inverse reaction. There's going to be, you know, air sucked out of the room. There's going to be so few people in there. So, yeah.
Presumably, you're hoping for everyone going, well, network manager and Beagle, I know about them. They're not very exciting. I'll go and watch Chikosha.
I'll go and watch Jackfield.
Sure. Jackfield's only a 5-minute lightning talk. It's not a real proper talk on the stage. Question for you, right? Yeah. I saw the videos last year of Jeff Waugh's 10x10 talk.
Yeah.
And you had this tiny, tiny stick figure, Jeff Waugh, standing in front of a screen that was about 200 feet high, right? Yeah. Is that the stage you're talking on?
I don't think so, no.
That was in Germany for a start.
That's unlikely.
Well, yeah, but presumably they're going to do a similar kind of thing.
It was
but on the videos, it looked like either the screen was a mile high or Jeff Waugh was about 1,000 miles away.
No, I think they have, like, the big main keynote stage.
Oh, but you're not on that one?
No, I think I'm going to be in one of the small rooms.
Bummer.
Talking of enormous screens, I think that takes us on quite nicely.
Oh, yeah!
How big is the screen going to be at Log Radio Live?
That's the size of a bloody snooker table, right?
12-foot screen. Imagine, on the main stage.
I did actually speak to some guys who hire out projectors and things, and they have an inflatable screen that's 30 feet wide. But we couldn't get it in the room, so we didn't get it. Plus, it was like £1,000 a day.
Ages to blow up as well, to make you dizzy.
I think at the end of the day,
I'm assuming you don't have a guy blowing into it.
At the end of the day, it would be a right letdown, wouldn't it?
Shut up.
I'd like to, at this point, thank my gracious employer for providing the funding to cover
the British taxpayer.
Shut up! providing the funding to cover the projector and some of the printing.
And I would also like to thank Bitemark.
Yeah, definitely.
Who provided the funding for everything else.
Yes. And don't get enough thanks on this show.
And don't get enough thanks on this show because they're great and they host our audio archives and everything.
And they're brilliant. We ask and they
always
provide.
And we love Matt Block and he's very, very tall and thin.
And handsome,
yes.
Matthew Block, caress me with
his. So yes, you have to come to Log Radio Live. It's in like 38 days or something.
Yeah.
Come to Guardic as well.
22nd, 23rd of June. July.
I believe, I'm a bit leery about committing to this, but I believe that by the time this show comes out, on Monday, we'll have the schedule online.
Yep.
Woo-hoo. Oh, sweet.
Leery about committing to this, but this is like the Jackfield thing. See, blackmail us into doing it, because I've said we're good.
I'd like to make a suggestion for the old Log Radio Live. Are there any boff spaces available still?
We've got 2 boff tracks that are full. Oh. But we're running a 3rd boff track that's going to have a couple of boffs already in it, and then it's going to be open so people can show up on the day and write on the...
Free boffs.
I'm not going to say what they're going to write on.
They're going to write on something.
They're going to write on something. Matt looks confused. Hang on. They're going to write on that, so people can show up on the day and run a boff session.
Tell you what, then meet me in the toilets, anyone, if you're interested.
What?
Well, I'm just thinking of where we're going to hold it.
What, open source cottaging?
No, seriously though.
Free software cottaging.
If anyone wants to meet up...
Meet Matthew in a toilet.
For a boff session.
If anyone wants to meet up at Log Radio Live and do a boff on my my favourite subject, which is marketing in open source, then please do contact me through the usual...
Are you going to do the boff?
if anyone's interested in coming along...
I thought we'd agree that none of us were doing stuff.
Then I would like to attend a BOF about
that's
marketing.
Why, that's why Laszlo's doing a Jocosha BOF. And we might show up.
That's why I want to chat with someone over email if anyone's interested in running one, and I will turn up to it.
Someone's also doing a Just for Men BOF. For aid.
Grecian 2000.
Just men, moustaches and beards.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Cool.
Lagrada Live is going to be really, really brilliant. The schedule will be online on Monday when this show comes out.
Yeah.
And you can subscribe to it with, like, iCal and Google Calendar and things like that.
Imagine
and it's really
such
cool.
Yeah.
If you come dressed as the Chini Raccoon, you can get him free.
Yeah.
Yeah, actual proper dress.
You have to be on all fours.
You can't just like paint a grey stripe in your hair. We're looking for a proper
that's pretty
dress
impressive
up.
If
what about
goes
maybe we should offer a concession if people can sing the GPL3 song?
Yes.
But you'd need to like form a band. Because you've got to have someone going, whoop, whoop, and someone going,
you do realise the whole line are just going to go, GPL, and then they're going to cut our earnings by 3 fifths.
The other thing is if anybody goes up to Richard Stallman dressed as a kipper, and gets a photo. We need to encourage that kind of behaviour.
No, we don't. Because Mr. Stallman's going to be at Lug Radio Live, isn't he?
Probably not.
Since it's Mr. Stallman.
Mr. Stallman's
there. We're going to say Mr. Eric Raymond.
Anyway, let's wrap it up because we're...
Really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. We've been trucking for an hour and 28 minutes.
It doesn't fit
people,
a CD anymore.
Is the show too long? Tell us.
Yeah, tell us.
Thank you very much. It's been a wonderful experience.
It has.
I'm moved. I won't be on the next show probably
because it's going to be the one from Guardek.
The next 5 shows if we do it every day.
Yeah.
Which is unlikely.
But if not, get nothing to say then.
Stuffed.
Eat yeah. My balls.
Get lost.
Yeah.
Get in touch. Show at lugradio.org.
Bye.
Bye.